everybody. Welcome to episode 445 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a spotlight on a creator-owned comic called Skies of Fire. We have one of the creators joining us today. He's been on the show before, but it's always great to have him back. Ray Chow is on the show, so welcome back, Ray. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been a while. It's been a while, and we have some exciting news with Skies of Fire. So why don't we start off by reminding the listeners kind of what the story is all about.
Sure. So Skies of Fire is a dieselpunk airship story. It's essentially a captain assembling her crew and hunting down a pirate terrorizing her kingdom. So it's sort of like Star Trek or Master and Commander, those type of ship stories, but with airships instead of other type of vessels.
Yeah, and you're one of the writers on the project, but you really have a pretty big team over at your publishing company, Mythopoeia. Why don't you give us a rundown of the other creators involved in this title?
Sure. So it's myself and my partner and co-creator and co-writer, Vincenzo Fierro. He actually came up with the idea. So we're kind of the driving forces behind the project. And our art team consists of Pablo Pepino on sequentials and inks, and Brian Valenza on colors. And we have Alex Bacor, who is a Romanian architect slash graphic designer, who contributes many of the ship designs, as well as a lot of the back matter codex materials that you can find in each issue. And every issue, of course, we like to find different variant artists that we can help contribute interesting new styles that we want to collaborate with. And every once in a while, we'll bring in, for instance, an artist like Joseph Endo, who is our cartographer, who's helped us map out the world and done other various graphic design documents for us as well. And then we also have Christian Dokolomeski as our new letterer as of this new issue, number 5, that we're working on.
Yeah, so it's a pretty big team. And you kind of guys do things a little, you know, differently. I mean, you know, having a guy that's got some architecture background to design the ships and you know, the buildings in the world, and a cartographer. I mean, it's really amazing to me, and it just goes to show kind of the passion you guys have for this project. I mean, it's a great story. It's presented beautifully. The art is spectacular. For you listeners who didn't join last time, if you buy the single issues, they're larger than a regular comic. It's glossy paper. It looks really, really great. And you get a lot of value. You know, this is all independently published, but between the back matter, the maps, you know, the great story with the beautiful art, I think they're great. I discovered it at WonderCon, and, you know, I've loved the world ever since. I wonder, Ray, if you could talk about what made you and your crew decide to tell this story first. You know, it's not, you know, you hear diesel steampunk with airships. It's not exactly, you know, a traditional story in a traditional setting. You know, sometimes it's kind of easier when you're starting a new publishing line to kind of go down the path of, you know, superheroes. It's kind of the one that everybody kind of starts off with. So I wonder why you guys decided to start off with this story, and were you at all worried about finding an audience early on?
Yeah, so the idea was originally my partner Vince's, and he always loved airships and wanted to tell an airship story. And him and I got along really well in college because we both were studying film, but we both liked the same type of film. So instead of our reference point being Taxi Driver or, you know, like a Tarantino film, like a lot of the other student filmmakers at NYU at the time, instead we loved, you know, Lord of the Rings and Star Wars. So we always got along in that respect. We were both kind of more on the geeky end of the spectrum, this kind of summer blockbuster end of the spectrum. And, after he did a couple drafts of Skies of Fire, I kind of hopped on board first by just giving him some critique and later doing full revisions. And after a couple of more drafts, we thought, hey, this is actually something pretty good. what do we do with it? And we both grew up reading comics. He grew up more on the European side of things with Tintin and kind of Asterisk and those type of things. And I grew up reading a lot of DC and Marvel, and later on Image, Walking Dead when it was first coming out, stuff that kind of generation of comics. And so I kind of suggested to him, hey, maybe we should turn it into a comic book instead. And to be honest, the thought about finding an audience or doing things a little bit differently never crossed our mind. We both thought it was a really cool idea, and we just wanted to make the best work that we possibly could. And so sort of our philosophy the entire time has been, if you build it, they will come. So we knew if we could get our vision out there, that people would like it, and that we'd be able to keep doing it. And thankfully, that's proven to be true.
Yeah, that's a great philosophy. It's a crowded marketplace right now. You know, I don't have to tell you in a way, as far as like the diversity of stories and the amount of really great stories, sequential art stories and comics that are out there right now. It really is a golden age. There's more and better stuff than there's ever been, but it does make the competition pretty fierce. But it goes to show that if you make a good product, that quality will win out. So I'm glad that you guys kind of stuck to your guns and knew that, hey, this is a new and interesting idea, and it can totally work. So it sounds like the response has been really great. You know, you guys have been around for a while. You feel like you've built a fan base both here and overseas, and you're in a good spot as far as like having that established fan base and having people receptive when you do put out new issues and new volumes.
Yeah, totally. I think that these days, I think it's going to be our fifth year going to cons and working on the project, as well as our other project, Glow. And one of the cool things about going to shows these days is just, you know, seeing people come up to you. See, like when you came up to me, I was like, oh man, so good to see you, you know, at San Diego Comic-Con. That's one of the best feelings, is just building that fan base and having people come up to you and be like, all right, what's the new issue? Or even if they have everything, they got it online or whatever, they're just like, oh, what else can I get to support you? So I think our fan base is definitely slowly but surely growing over the past couple of years. Yeah.
Yeah. And did you have some new readers that discovered the book at San Diego this year? Was that a success on that side of the spectrum?
Yeah, San Diego was actually a really, really big show for us, because I guess for a couple of shows in 2018 and maybe the tail end of 2017, sometimes going to a lot of shows, and I'm sure you talk to a lot of creators, it becomes sort of a routine, and sometimes a burden, you know. And I was definitely feeling a lot of con burnout in those years, but after talking to some other creators, I realized that I should probably approach it a little bit differently. So I spent a lot of time before San Diego doing things like thinking about how to redo our booth and attracting people with the display of the booth, rather than just trying to cold pitch everybody that walked by. And also having the volume, the trade hardback of Skies of Fire Volume 1, that really helped as well, because a lot of fans will only read in collected volumes or only read in floppy. So I feel like the majority will prefer a collected hardback, or it seemed to be something that was an easy sell for a lot of people checking out our work for the first time.
That's great. I'm glad to hear you guys did well. And I completely understand and agree and can relate to, you know, doing a lot of shows, and it starts to feel like a grind. Like you started doing this because you loved comics, you know, and telling stories, you know, you said yourself, and it's great to be able to do something that you love, and it shows your passion. But when it starts to feel, you know, like a grind and a job, I mean, that's like, I had the same experience, actually at San Diego, on Saturday night. I was burnt out. I was like, man, I had done so much already. And I told myself, you know, I had a couple interviews on Sunday. I'm going to, you know, obviously I'm going to honor my obligations, but the rest of the time I'm going to kind of fan out, like just be a geek and remember why am I doing this again? And it was good. It, you know, it was a way to kind of recharge my batteries. So I totally can relate to that. So, let's talk a little bit more about the story. In broad terms, you know, I just reread it, when I picked up the hardcover myself from you at San Diego, and it's like you could look at it as a story of revenge, or you could look at it as a story of redemption. So I wonder, it's something I wanted to ask you. Do you as the creator, do you see it as a story of William out there looking for revenge, or is he looking for redemption, or is it a little bit of both?
I think it's definitely, we try and play on that duality a lot, like, kind of the two sides of the same coin idea. And I think, what we really try to do is, from William's side, he thinks that he has, really noble intentions and that he's doing it for a great cause or, whatnot. But I think part of him is just really inherently selfish, and he has this major character flaw where he can't quite see things from other people's perspectives, or even if he does, he just sort of, he's so bullish and he's so single-minded about his goal that he will often do a lot of atrocious things, or a lot of push his agenda forward in ways that other people might not. And I think that Helen, our other main character, she sees William as a bit of a kindred soul at first, because she is very ambitious and she too wants to earn the loyalty of the crew and wants to accomplish this mission. And it's that sort of that agreement that binds them. But that's what gets tested over and over and over again throughout the course of the story.
Yeah, and for you listeners, obviously we want you to pick it up and read it if you haven't, you know, if you haven't yet. So we don't want to get too spoilery, but the story is, you know, about the ship that came and attacked a city, and now there's some, I guess you'd say, undesirables that kind of team up with the military to go after the antagonist of the story. And so because you have a crew, because it is you know, an interesting and rich world that Ray and Vinny, as I like to call them, have made here, but it's that background of diesel steampunk and the interesting world that it's unlike anything I've ever seen in a comic before. That's kind of a character in and of itself. But if you don't inhabit that world with interesting characters that are compelling, that you can kind of root for and relate to, then the story doesn't really, really go anywhere. But that's not the case here, because they are written so, so well and so kind of realistically. And so you certainly can see, okay, you have the military side of it, the crew that's kind of more straight laced and by the book. And then you have kind of the undesirables that William recruits for their kind of knowledge of the area they're going to search for Del Monte. So, it brings up another interesting theme. That's trust, you know, because in order for a crew or a team, you know, if any of us have played sports, you'll know this maybe at your job. Depending on what kind of job it is, there needs to be like a certain level of trust with the people that you're working next to or on your team, right? And so being that these two kind of sides of the crew, there's a lot of animosity there and they don't trust each other. So that theme it runs throughout the story. And then also with Helen and William, there's this, thought of sacrifice, right? They're both taking a big risk, both like personally and literally because of where they're going, in search of Del Monte. So, I love the idea of the fact that they're heading into danger. They're sort of making a sacrifice or a possible sacrifice, putting their lives on the line here, with this crew that may not trust each other. It's just a very compelling story. So I wonder, Ray, do you and Vincenzo, do you approach it from the big ideas top down, or do you just tell the story and then realize after that, hey, these are kind of the themes we're exploring, and we can kind of lean into those a little bit more here or there, or with what this person does or that person.
Yeah. Oh, well, first of all, thank you so much for the kind words. Like, as a writer, you know, it's one thing when you talk about the amazing art, because, you know, that's really great. But when you talk about like those themes, that's what really puts a big smile on my face, because I'm like, yes, you know, like, that's awesome. That's so cool.
Reminds you why you're doing it, and kind of gives you validation. Hey, people are out there understanding what we're doing.
Yeah. It's like, oh, they like it beyond just Pablo's awesome art and Brian's awesome colors, you know? So that's thank you, first of all. And yeah, I mean, I think you picked up on a lot of them. And, you know, I've been thinking, so we have the Kickstarter up, and I feel like a lot of new eyeballs are on the project, and a lot of people are commenting and saying, hey, what's your creative process, and how do you guys actually come up with this stuff? So I've been thinking about that a lot lately, and I think that for me and Vince, in terms of the writing, a lot of it is a process of, it's always rewriting, and it's always a process of rediscovery. Like, you know, at this point, we've done so many hundreds of drafts of this story. And it started out, you know, when we first started out, a lot of it was very kind of cartoony, almost Disney-esque, in terms of how the pirates interacted with the blue coats and stuff like that. And it was honestly, it was a bit cheesier. But as we've written more and more drafts, it's gotten a little bit darker, and those themes that you brought up of trust, of loyalty, have sprung up and kind of been refined over time. So, you know, it always starts from an outline of like, okay, we know roughly what the large story beats are. So we have that always guiding us, and we know we have to get to certain places. But then whenever we write, it's sort of like one of us will throw out an idea, we'll do a draft, and then we'll go, oh, okay, maybe that's not quite working. And then we'll sleep on it. And then when we come back to it next time, we'll kind of pitch each other, or we'll try and break the story, right? That's sort of the writer's term. And we'll try to like break the story again. And oftentimes the way we break the story is by doing something we've already thought of a lot of drafts ago, but just somehow it's better. It's different in just a ever so slightly way. And it's usually different thematically, where it reinforces some of the things that you've stewed on, or you've thought about, or about what motivates the character. So those sort of themes that you brought, like trust, loyalty, sacrifice, kind of get pushed more to the forefront. So for issue 4, a lot of it was about the crew coming together. For our next upcoming issue, a lot of it is about faith. It's about being superstitious, about like this idea of religion, of fate, of destiny. And that's just something that that one was sort of like, we looked at it first by writing this prayer in the beginning of it, and then that sort of kind of shaped how we viewed the rest of the issue. So I would say that it's more of the plot guides where we need to go, but in looking at the plot and in rewriting things, you discover what's important thematically over and over again, and you seem to rediscover story beats, and it just becomes better as you think about the story more and rewrite the story more.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. And something else there that you said kind of reminded me of something. I hear so many writers talk about once you've lived with a character for a while, you know, a long enough period of time, and certainly you and Vince have been working with these characters for a while, the characters all of a sudden it becomes not – you're not like the puppet master like moving the character around, but the characters is telling you when you're taking the story or the character kind of in the wrong direction. No, they wouldn't necessarily do that. This is what they would actually do. Are you finding that to be true? Like it's to the point with these characters like Helen and William, where they're kind of dictating to you what their next move is?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, yeah, that's one of the things we're dealing with right now. You know, we look at the characters like, well, we have to, what would so-and-so do in this situation? And that has become, you know, we have like the overplot that we like, again, it's like certain story beats we have to get to in one way or another. But in thinking about, well, how do we get there? Yeah, definitely a problem solving tool is, okay, what would that character realistically do in this scenario? And just going off of that, as opposed to coming up with stuff. Now, it really feels more like, yeah, the characters are so kind of fleshed out. It's just thinking about what they would do and how they would realistically act. And as long as we're true to that, hopefully something good comes out.
Yeah, and I think when writers are true to that, it comes out in the quality of the story, and it makes the characters feel more alive, right? Because as a reader, a longtime comic reader, I can always tell when a writer's like, well, I know they really wouldn't do this necessarily, but I really need to get over here to this story beat, so I'm going to kind of force them. And then as a reader, you can almost always tell, and then it ends up pulling you out of the story. And yeah, I don't know if you find that to be true or not.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess it's hard sometimes too, because you do so many drafts, and at the end of the day, all you hope for is that it's, you know, it lives. Like, at a certain point, you kind of just let it go, you know, like you lose objectivity when you're working on something. You're like, I don't know if this is good or not, but this is the best we could do at the time. So I think we get a lot of that. So it's great hearing that people are responding to the writing of the work, because again, it's not something that's immediately visible when you buy the book or when you check out the book. But I'm glad you like it so far.
Yeah, I think, you know, once you get yourself immersed in the world, and a lot of that is with the back matter, it's so rich and it helps kind of flesh things out. It really gives you a better understanding of the characters. But you mentioned the Kickstarter. So let's talk about that for a few minutes here. Your fourth Kickstarter, I believe, is currently running. So tell us about some of the rewards and the tiers that readers and fans can get by pledging.
Yeah, it's actually our seventh, wow. Including our, so it's our fifth Skies of Fire Kickstarter and our seventh overall. We've had two Glow Kickstarters so far. So this Kickstarter specifically was to fund the print run of the collected volume of issues 1 through 4 that you saw at San Diego Comic-Con, Jace. So, you know, I fronted the money for that to get it at San Diego Comic-Con, but we sort of needed the support of our fans to actually make it happen. Yeah, that's it right there. So mostly we're selling the book over there, but we are also doing a collector's edition with a nice book print done by Joseph Vandal. That's individually numbered as well. You can get our really nice art prints that we started selling at San Diego as well. You know, printed on really nice archival paper, certain really detailed panels that we love, that we thought would look good framed, our posters, of course. And then we have various bundles that include, you know, more or less of that stuff, but just in different quantities.
Yeah. So it sounds like if someone's new to the world of Skies of Fire, this is like the perfect thing. Like you get, you know, the whole story in a nice hardcover. I was holding it up to show Ray there that, you know, he knows I picked up a hardcover myself at San Diego, and it's a beautiful product. It has the nice like cloth binding, looks great on your shelf. And it's a gorgeous book. I love the fact that the single issues that they do are the oversized. It gives such a showcase to the art. And this is the same thing. Like, not only would this look great on your bookshelf, but just on your coffee table, right? People come over and it's going to catch their eye. It's something different. Hey, flip through. Hey, this is great. So I really would encourage like new readers, go take part in the Kickstarter. There's a couple weeks left. And you can pick up the whole story. The other thing I would say is for those listeners maybe who have it already, this is a great presentation. You know, it really is. You know, the floppies are great, but again, you can't really, you know, showcase them on your bookshelf or have it on your coffee table for people to check out. So, I would encourage you guys to go and check out the Kickstarter, and I'll put a link in the show notes so you can just click there and go over and check it out. And I also saw as a reward there was a digital copy of issue 5. The next volume of Skies of Fire as one of the rewards. Is that right, Ray?
Yeah. So, so we're actually releasing it to all of the backers of this current campaign when it's ready. And that's sort of been our model since the second Kickstarter release. So, we started out as a Kickstarter project. That's sort of where our fan base lives and where we get a lot of our support from. And the way that we've incentivized our Kickstarter fans over the years is that every time we're about to launch a new Kickstarter campaign, we release the digital copy, free to our previous campaign. So we thought it would be a nice little pack-in. So we do that, and that gets people excited about it. Or, you know, I feel like some people read it, but most people are like, oh, you know, it's coming out. I'm not going to tempt myself. I'll wait for the hard or the print issue. And then what we do is that every campaign we do for the first 72 hours, we send out a huge email blast to everybody, and we also have a early bird tier that incentivizes our old fans to come back by being able to get the new book. In this case, it was, you know, the collected 1 through 4. Next Kickstarter will be issue number 5 for a really, really discounted price those first 72 hours. And that helps us get our funding usually pretty quickly. It allows us to have a huge number of backers on Kickstarter and raise a lot of money, and that helps us with the visibility on that platform. It lets us sort of be near the top of the rankings for the comic category for whenever we launch a campaign.
Yeah, I think it's a really great model. And, you know, the fact, so like you were saying, this one is for the collected edition 1 through 4, but the fact that you're getting 5, you know, the story's continuing. You know, a lot of times I'll see Kickstarters and it, you know, sometimes I'll even support Kickstarters and it's for a chunk of story. But maybe they don't have the ability to generate revenue outside of Kickstarters. And so they're kind of, stuck in that mode where they've got to like have a successful Kickstarter to produce what they have and then, or what they're, you know, offering as a reward for that Kickstarter and then hope they have enough left over to continue the story. And it's not that those aren't worth supporting, but it's nice to know with Skies of Fire, okay, this is for the collected 1 through 4, but we already know the story's still continuing. There's going to be more to come because here's an issue 5. I think that's awesome. I know how dedicated to this title and the other titles that you and Vince do that you guys all are, but it's just nice to be reminded like, hey, there is more coming.
Yeah, definitely. It's something that we, I feel like we're part of this indie Kickstarter movement that's been going on for the last last half decade or so now, I would say. And it's still, you know, it's maturing a bit, but people are kind of still trying to figure out, like, yeah, that's a question we got a lot early on too, is like, well, how do you know that you guys will finish? And the question is, the answer is and was, well, we don't really. You really only have our word to go by because we're not supported by a publisher. We're completely independent. So, you know, any number of things can happen. And hopefully over time that we've shown that we do have a track record and we do intend to get this story finished and that, you can rely on us to run good campaigns that fulfill in a timely manner and that we're continuing to produce material with the money that we receive and that we really dedicate to both of our books.
Yeah. And no surprise to me, you know, I saw you in San Diego, I go and check the Kickstarter. It was already funded. So any of you listeners that are wondering, well, you know, am I going to pledge my money? And then it doesn't fulfill. And so then, you know, I'm not out the cash because, you know, it's Kickstarter. If you're not aware, a project doesn't fully fund, then you don't actually, they don't accept your pledge. But then you also have the campaigns that do successfully fulfill, and then you never get your whatever it is that the reward is offered. So again, I think Ray and his partners, his collaborators, they have a track record of you know, fulfillment. It's there. You know the book's already printed. I have a copy, so you know for sure you're going to get it because it's already fully funded and the book's already been made. So it's just a matter of getting it into your hands. So do you feel like this has been one of your most successful Kickstarters so far, Ray?
Oh yeah, definitely. It's been the most successful so far, and it doesn't look like it's slowing down. So it's kind of exciting. It feels like our first one in that sense. We're like, whoa, okay. And, it's great because like we finally, you know, we might be getting a little an extra bit of cash, and that allows us to think about what we want to do creatively with it. Like, okay, what can we, how can we expand the world? You know, like maybe we start a new project or whatnot. And to your point about us having the books ahead of time, you know, that's, and fulfilling, it's, we've gotten better as the years have gone by. So it's not like we don't need Kickstarter anymore. Like, definitely if the Kickstarter didn't fund, I would probably be out, we would be out 15 grand or so. And then that would probably mean the end of Skies of Fire, to be honest. But we had enough trust in our fan base that I felt comfortable putting down a big credit card payment. And because I put down the big credit card payment, that means right after the campaign ends, now we can fulfill it in, like, say a month or two after the campaign ends, once the money clears, as opposed to waiting for the books to arrive from our printer in a couple of months and then fulfilling it that way. So I guess that's sort of like the maturation of the business side of things, is that we know that we can count on people to support us now. We can take a bit of more calculated risks in terms of pre-ordering or ordering books ahead of time, knowing that people will show up and buy it, using Kickstarter more as a pre-order platform.
Yeah, that's a great point there. The fact that you've already have them printed and you're not, you know, wait, okay, if we've got the Kickstarter money, now we can put the order in at the printer, have to wait for it to, you know, get shipped, all that stuff. So yeah, that's really, really cool. Being that you have run so many successful Kickstarters, I just wanted to ask real quick, there may be listeners out there who are creatives that are thinking about giving it a try. Do you have like one bit of advice or maybe a couple things to somebody who's thinking about it that, you know, here's one of the things that can really help you be successful?
Yeah, a couple of major tips. Number one, keep the video short. Keep it a minute, 2 minutes long. Pitch the story. And people love to get invested in the creators behind the project, but what they want, like, a, you know, like a short pitch, and maybe a little bit of behind the scenes stuff. And that formula has worked really, really well for us. I see a lot of creators with videos that are a little bit too quirky, a little bit too creative. And even if the project is really good, it's a little bit too long, and maybe people stop watching the video after, you know, 20 seconds because it's just too much of this or that. Keep it visually oriented in terms of the pitch. Really, you want, so everything that you're trying to do on a Kickstarter, it's basically like a business prospectus. So you're just trying to show that you're legit, that you know what you're doing. So the more stuff, the more information that you show, that you've thought about things, that you've planned things out, I feel like that lends to your credibility a lot. Keep it visually oriented because people like looking at pictures. It's a comic book, right? People want to see what the art looks like. So that's really important. And finally, just try and design it like a snowball. So like, you want to try and get whatever fan base or support that you know you can rely on early on to help push the project on the platform so that the platform works for you and that you're visible. So three main things, number of backers you have, number of funds you've raised, and the time you've raised it in. You want a lot of backers, you want a lot of money, and you want to have those two things in a short amount of time. So if you can get your fan base to support you early on, that pushes you high in the visibility and ensures that you'll have a really big campaign.
Awesome. So, and I've asked creators before that have been on the show for tips, and I haven't heard those particular ones. So you've heard it here, listeners, from a very successful Kickstarter runner here, Ray. So heed that advice if you're thinking about doing a Kickstarter. I wanted to touch on some of the other properties from Mythopia, because I know we have Glow, which, you know, we've talked about on the show before. I haven't read it yet, to be honest, but I did pick up the three first single issues, and I'm excited to hopefully dig into it this weekend. And then I also saw on your website that you have another property coming soon. Do you want to tell our listeners about the Glow and the other property that you guys are working on right now?
Yeah, so Glow is our second title, and it's also a major Kickstarter project. That is a coming-of-age story that takes place in the world where magic caused the fall of civilization. So kind of old-school D&D players. It's sort of like the Dark Sun universe, where magic is this like life essence that has grown kind of cancerous over time, and that's the apocalyptic version. But it also instead of being like kind of like heavy metal in its presentation, it's more kind of like anime-esque, and it's more like Legend of Avatar, Legend of Korra in its presentation. And it has a lot of technology, magical technology. So the way I pitch that, I always say it's mutants and magic, wizards and witches and warlords, and guns and golems, basically. And that is more, that one deals with a lot of themes of sort of responsibility. What do you do, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, and also issues of trust. That's a big one that I always come down to. That one's going really well. We're on the brink of finishing up our third issue, which will be up on Kickstarter again, and hopefully I'll have it at the shows this coming year in tail end of 2018 and 2019. That one's pretty much independent. It's all grown up. It's just a matter of getting the work done, and you know, we're trying to go faster. That's always like the big critique of our stuff is that, yeah, we know we're slow. We're trying to go faster. We really are. And then as far as Recall goes, I haven't talked about Recall in a long time. So Recall is sort of like the lost child of Mythopia at this point. To be honest, we talked about removing it from our website just because there hasn't been any progress on the book in a while. But Recall is about a colony ship that sets sails for a different galaxy or a planet, and it's 800 years. It's an 800 year cryo journey. But about 300 years into their journey, they get sent back. They get recalled back to Earth. The members of this colony ship, they have this sort of like a version of Alzheimer's called Somria, and it happens when you go into deep sleep. So you can't quite remember who you are. You have a lot of memory issues, identity issues, and members of the crew suffer. They all suffer to a certain degree, but some way more than others. And also when they arrive on Earth, they find that it's a purple planet with a small ring on it. So they basically have to figure out what the heck happened and what's going on. And a lot of what we wanted to do with that one was to, I'm getting all excited about it, pitching it again, but like we haven't really worked on it in a while, but we wanted it to be really like a golden age of pulp, kind of like our take on like Burroughs or like John Carter of Mars, you know? So when they get to Earth, they find all sorts of crazy, they find like techno barbarians who like, they have like kind of Bronze Age weaponry, but when they hit you with it, you just kind of explode, like your brains explode Paul Verhoeven style, you know, and they're like, what the heck is going on? Some of them want to continue on their journey. Others are like, well, we have a planet right here. Why don't we'll just colonize this one? And it's Earth, and you know, them finding out what happened and like, does it even matter? You know, like, and questions of identity and kind of like duty and honor and what does it mean to have a mission, stuff like that. So Recall, unfortunately, was put on hiatus because one of the things we realize, Vince and I, is that although we're rather successful in the comics, it's not successful enough yet to the point that we can quit our full-time jobs.
Right.
And there's only so much stuff that we can do. So between Skies of Fire and Glow and all of the Kickstarter campaigns, all the business side of things, we just found out that we didn't have enough time to give that project the love that we really needed to give it. So we were like, okay, we just need to focus on Skies and Glow and just finish out those projects first or get to a certain point or have additional resources where maybe we can add on a third project. So yeah, them's the breaks, Jace. That's the reality of the biz. You know, there's not a lot of money in comics, unfortunately, and it's tough being an indie creator. Even one that's like had some success, it's still a lot of times you're still looking at the bottom line.
Right. Yeah. And that's a good point. I totally understand, you know, it is tough out there. And, you know, a lot of you listeners may have been surprised to hear Ray talk about, yes, in fact, I still have a day job. Again, I can completely relate. You know, I'm putting out 9-10 episodes a week now, you know, on my own, and I still have the full-time day. You know, this does not make money for me. It costs me money, but I do it because I love it. And for, you know, for the same reason that a lot of the creators work in comics. You don't get into comics to be a creator to get rich. If you want to get rich, you chose the wrong profession.
Yes, 100%. Like, do not bark up that tree.
Exactly. But you do it because you love comics and it's your passion. So it Recall sounds great. I will patiently wait for it. And I actually have an idea I'm going to throw out to you when we finish recording here, just something to percolate on if it ever happens. So I'm not going to take up any more of your time, Ray. I really appreciate you joining me. It's always great to catch up with you. As always, is there anything else you want to share with our listeners as kind of like a closing thought here?
Jace, you're my favorite comic press guy. I love talking to you, man. I'll always do an interview with you. I love talking to you. You're a great interviewer. Keep doing what you do, man. I know it's a struggle out there, but you know, you bring a lot to this community, so I appreciate you.
Hey, man, I'm very grateful to hear you say that. The check's in the mail, by the way. I did not know Ray was gonna say that. But I really appreciate that, man. I really appreciate that. So, well, let's finish with some social media contacts. If any of our listeners want, you know, obviously I'll put the Kickstarter link in there, but and a link to the website. Is there anywhere else on social media that they that fans both old and new should be following to get news about the fire and your other projects?
So you can find us, you can find Skies of Fire at Skies O Fire 1F. You can find Glow at Glow Comic, and we're on, you know, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, although to be honest, we're pretty bad with social media. One thing that we've been trying, that we just launched is our Patreon page, and we're trying to offload a lot of the stuff that we would put on social media onto the Patreon page. Some of it behind the paywall, some of it not. So, we are Mythopoeia, straight up Mythopoeia on Patreon. And that's sort of where we're trying to live these days. That's where we're putting our work in progress, our thoughts, et cetera, et cetera.
Great. And again, listeners, there will be links in the show notes for all of those places. So once again, I want to thank everyone for joining us. Please tell your friends about us, subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on iTunes. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on those platforms as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at that site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. Quick reminder, next show for me is Comic-Con Palm Springs, coming up the last weekend in August. So if you're going to be there, let me know. I always love to meet listeners, and I'll even hook you up with a free Comic Source lanyard. So I want to thank Ray once again for joining me.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jace, for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and we appreciate you listeners hanging in there with us, and we'll talk to you next time.